All rise. The Illinois Public Court, Third Division, is now in session. The Honorable Justice Margaret S. McBride is presiding.
Everyone sit down. Crowd has lessened quite a bit since the last case.
Direct Auto Insurance versus O'Neill.
All right, would both of the attorneys please step up to the podium and identify yourselves for the record.
Good morning, Judge Sam Shellis for Direct Auto.
And good morning, Your Honor. Angela Kurtz on behalf of the appellee, Takeshi O'Neill.
Counsel, your last name, could you spell it?
Yes, K-U-R-T-Z.
Oh, Kurtz. Okay.
Yes.
All right. Good morning, Ms. Kurtz.
Good morning.
All right. Each of you will have about 15 minutes to present argument. And from that, Shellis, you may save some time out for rebuttal.
Hey, please, the court. I'm Sam Shellis for Direct Auto. I appreciate the opportunity to speak to you orally and live for the first time in a long time.
Yeah, let me ask you a couple questions right off the bat. Okay, get right to the issue.
Okay.
This case. What would the insurance company have done differently if the notice had come in a timely manner?
If they had a statement, which they didn't, they could have investigated. If they had information,
Let's start that. They could have investigated. Well, why didn't they investigate when they got the notice?
Because we had less than 30 days before the statute would be expired. We had less than 30 days to see that a suit was filed and challenge American Access. We had less than 30 days to do anything. But I want to caution something, and I hope you won't find it disrespectful. It's not meant that way.
No, I don't find anything you do disrespectful, Mr. Shell.
That question goes to prejudice. And Justice McBride last time, and just a few moments ago during the oral argument, chastised me last time, and I learned my lesson, which is the Supreme Court says what it says. The Supreme Court says, once you don't get reasonable notice of an occurrence, the policyholder may not recover regardless of whether the lack of reasonable notice prejudiced the insurer. So let's assume for the moment, just for the moment, we weren't prejudiced. That's not sufficient. It is not the sine qua non of deciding this case, whether we're prejudiced. The five elements that Lavorsi Marine gave and this court gave in a decision just 2 or 3 weeks ago, that Fidelity versus Peoples 2022 Illinois App 21044.
Did you ask to cite this?
No, it was just issued about a week and a half ago.
But well, normally, you know, if you want to, you can ask to cite supplemental authority, and then your opposing counsel could respond.
I understand.
And then,
so
talk about it.
Well, but the five elements are the five elements.
So, counsel, just to be clear, so you're saying that you were not prejudiced. Your client was not prejudiced.
No, I'm saying that prejudice is not a requirement. It's only one of the five elements. I am saying we were prejudiced. First of all, a AAA requires you hire a lawyer for the most part and defend an adversarial proceeding. The purpose of UM is mostly not to have an adversarial proceeding and be able to settle the case without hiring a lawyer and going to AAA and costing money, which is, there's an expense, which now is increased. Secondly, we're prejudiced because we only had 30 days or less to determine if the other party was uninsured and why, to determine whether American Access denial was correct, to take a statement and find out what happened in the accident. And we were also prejudiced because when you get notice of an accident 2 years after the accident, you're not likely to find any witnesses or be able to find anything. And we only had 30 days to do that. So I'm saying we were
30
prejudiced.
30 days, just like the notification requirement that the insured has to give.
I do not argue the 30-day rule, Judge. The court has previously...
I know you're not. But, and this is not really an issue in this case, but the address that the attorney said he sent the initial notice to was listed on the policy, wasn't it?
Except...
Well, was it? Or
yes.
Okay.
But it was a former address, and more importantly, he sent a green card that he got back unsigned. He sent two faxes to the wrong fax number that weren't our fax number. Let's go through this.
But he did send notice, or at least he said he sent notice, didn't get a green card back on the address that you had in the policy.
My answer to that is trying to give us notice is not notice.
Yes, of course.
It's totally irrelevant. I respect...
And you know we're not reviewing a summary judgment here.
No, you're not.
Okay,
and
so
I would
suggest that, don't you? You suggest we should be reviewing this de novo, don't you?
You could review the summary judgment as merged within the trial if you wish to, but let me explain why he abused his discretion under that standard. taking...
So you're not giving up on summary judgment.
I'll argue the abuse of discretion. Taking all the evidence as true.
Now it's a bench trial.
Yes, taking all the evidence...
You're saying it's an abuse of discretion?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Taking all the evidence as true, there is zero evidence that the insured gave us notice except on the 23rd month. The judge below said there's an extraordinary circumstance here. Well, what is it? We know what it is. Mr. Cheskis is incompetent and committed malpractice. And I hate to be that blunt, but that's what it was. On August 9th of 2017, there was an accident. The day after, he had a lien to American Access. It still took him a year and a half after American Access denied the claim to send direct auto notice by the AAA. So what did he do for 2 years, for 23 months? Well, he says he tried to send notice to an address that bounced. He sent faxes to a fax that bounced. So what is the extraordinary circumstance that the court considered? Well, there's only one. He tried hard. That's not notice. Trying hard is not notice. The five elements that the court...
Just interrupting for a second. But what about direct auto? Direct auto didn't do anything either. They sat on their hands. All they did is file the declaratory action. They never conducted an investigation. They never made any kind of determination as to liability. They just filed a declaratory action.
And the reason for that is the Supreme Court says if we don't get reasonable notice, prejudice is not required and we're entitled to enforce the contract as written. That's the reason. I have to be that one. We're not required to do that to show prejudice. It's not an element. And as I listened to the argument before this one, when Justice McBride asked that question, aren't we compelled to follow Supreme Court precedent? That's what Lavorsi Marine says. And when you look at the five elements, the language of the policy, they have to give reasonable notice in writing with details. They never gave us a statement. Even after they filed the AAA, we never got a statement.
Let's stop for a moment there.
Okay.
Now, isn't it true that in the policy, the address of the company was at 330 South Wells?
Yes.
Okay, so if the lawyer followed the policy, he would send the notice to 330 South Wells.
But if you send notice to an address and the mail bounces, you know it's not the right address. Whether the policy says blue, green, or
anything. Well, doesn't the insurance company have the obligation then when they change an address to send notice to every one of their policyholders that now we have a new address to send for claims?
No, not that I know of from the Department of Regulations, but I would also emphasize something else. In the modern world, he could have done two clicks on Google and found our address. If that's what they're going to argue, that he couldn't find us, that's absurd. I mean, it would have taken him 4 seconds.
No, but if you're going to require someone to notify you in 30 days and you keep the address that's no longer valid, you think the insurance company has no obligation to its insured to just send out a letter saying this address is incorrect? This is where you have to send all those important notices, and you've only got 30 days to do it.
Well, we're not claiming the 30-day clause, and
I understand.
The 30 days to me is just not relevant because we're not claiming it.
Yeah.
It's reasonable notice.
No, but the notice, you are claiming the notice, and the notice here was defective because the insurance company never updated anything to suggest we've moved.
But I want to suggest something else. Even the notice they sent was no statement, no details, no nothing. We got nothing for 2 years. And I want to emphasize the first element is full details in writing. We never got that. The second element is the sophistication of the insurer. Well, obviously, the insured had a lawyer the day after the accident. They can't claim they didn't know what was going on. The lawyer testified he knew that Direct Auto was the UM carrier. We asked him in cross-examination. He said, yeah, I knew it was Direct Auto, and I knew I had UM with them.
Yeah, but your policy doesn't say that they have to give a detailed statement. It just says notice.
No, it does, Your Honor. In paragraph 3A, it says they have to give details of the accident and the circumstances and who was in the accident. It does say that.
Okay.
And it says so in writing. They didn't do any of that. And they've never done that to this date. Even when the AAA was filed, there's no statement. So they've never done that. That's on page 3A of the policy indicates that. I have the policy with me. Details, who were the witnesses, what happened and when. And they never did that. Sophistication of the insured, they can't argue. Diligence, they can't argue.
You said the judge abused his discretion. he found the 23 months was long, but he actually didn't find in your favor. So what case do you think suggests that he abused his discretion?
Well, Lavorsi-Marie, because he said, I find the time unreasonable, but there's an explanation. So what is the explanation? The only explanation in the record is that the lawyer incompetently tried to send us notice. That's not a reason. That's not anything. It's not an explanation. It's not a reason. It's not a justification. It doesn't meet the five factors. The five factors that Lavorsi-Marie set out. The fourth factor is, did they realize that he was injured and he was going to make a claim? Well, obviously, that was the case because he testified right at the day after the accident. He knew that he was going to make a UM claim. So none of the factors are met. So the judge abused his discretion because he said, without reviewing the five factors, the extraordinary situation here is the lawyer tried.
I thought the judge found that they substantially complied with the policy's notice provision. Didn't he make that finding?
Yes.
Okay, so
it's wrong as a matter of law. It's just not true. There's nothing before you in the record that justifies it.
Weren't there two notices that were forwarded to Direct Auto?
Yes.
What was wrong with the second notice?
It didn't get to us either because they sent it to the wrong address.
And what was that address? Another bad address that was in the policy?
They sent it, a green card notice, to a post office box. You can't get a signature on a green card from a post office box. And we cross-examined Mr. Cheskis on that and said, why would you send a green card notice to a post office box when you know it can't get signed? How would you expect it to be received?
And what did he say?
Nothing of consequence, because there is nothing to say. What can you say to a response? I mean, we don't need to be lawyers to know you can't get a signature at a post office box. So we did ask him that. The fact is,
So where did you get the address from for the post office box?
The post office box was the correct post office box, but nobody signs a green card there, so the mail bounced. In other words, if you send a letter to a post office box that's correct by green card, you know, certified mail, there's nobody to sign it, so it goes back. So there's no dispute we never got it. And I want to emphasize an answer both to your question and Justice McBride. The judge found we got no notice till July 9th. There was absolutely no dispute about that. So the question the court must ask is, what's the excuse? It's that simple. Well,
he had a bad lawyer.
That's too bad for him. He should get a better one. That's not my problem. That is not my problem under the five elements of this Supreme Court that has made that clear. And again, using the language, the policyholder may not recover regardless of whether the lack of reasonable notice prejudiced the insurer. If you follow that, as I believe we're all obligated to do, then what is their argument? They tried hard. They made a lot of mistakes. That's not my problem. The judge erred because he said this notice would ordinarily be considered unreasonable. But there's an extraordinary reason. Well, the only extraordinary reason that's before you is Mr. Cheskis' incompetence.
But I thought he was concluding that the attorney did, that the insured substantially complied.
No, that's not how I read that order, Judge. When you look at the order, that's not how I read the language. It says on the last page, The 23 months is an extraordinary delay. Absent credible evidence from defendant's counsel about his effort to provide notice. I could not imagine that this could be excused. But with all due respect, his effort to provide notice is not notice. That effort to provide notice is irrelevant. He's excusing Mr. Cheskis' incompetence and no practice and blaming us for it. Well, his incompetence is not my problem, and it's not Direct Auto's problem. It says a credible explanation for the delay. Well, the credible explanation for the delay is Mr. Cheskis not doing his job.
Well, does the notice breach have to be material?
It doesn't have to be prejudicial.
Right, but doesn't it have to be material?
And I would argue it is in the following respects. The notice provision says you have to give details of what happened in the accident and in a written statement. We got nothing. The notice.
What did you get in that notice that you finally got?
A one-sentence letter that says I'm the lawyer and I have a lien. And then, which we never got, but then the
How
notice.
How did you get the name?
AAA. The only notice we got was the AAA notice that says, I demand arbitration. That was the notice.
How did Jimenez's name come into any of this then?
Jimenez was the insurance.
The uninsured motorist. Right?
Allegedly uninsured motorist insured by American Access. That's
right.
Correct.
Right.
The only notice that we received, which this judge below said we got, was on July 9th of 2019, a AAA notice, which, as I'm sure you're all familiar with, is a 3 or 4 sentence notice that says, I'm the lawyer and I'm filing a AAA, and here's the fee, pay it over at AAA. It contained zero information about the accident. Zero statement, zero anything. So, in answer to your question, Justice Breyer, we got nothing. So, that is material. We got nothing.
And I want to stop you there for a moment. You know, when you get a notice from AAA, they give you the application for the arbitration, too.
Yes, the second page contained it, but it doesn't say anything on the application.
Yeah, it does. It shows everything about the accident and the application for the arbitration.
All it said is there was a hit-and-run accident, and that was it.
It gives the names of the parties.
It gives where
the accident happened.
I don't recall that it did in this case. I have to look back at the page.
I mean,
that was all it said.
You know, in my lifetime, I must have received 100 of those notices, okay? And that's what that always said.
But that's not a statement of the circumstances of who hit who, what happened, where are the bills, how were you hurt, none of the things that we would normally get.
But wasn't that evidence all still available to you or to your client?
It would be available in an adversarial proceeding at AAA, but it wouldn't be available before the AAA when we wanted it. And secondly, again, whether evidence is available goes to prejudice. And the Supreme Court has said that's simply not the case.
Is that the case when the notice is not complied with? Isn't that what you just told us earlier?
Yes, when the notice is unreasonable.
And here the judge found the notice was substantially complied with.
No, he didn't. He said the notice was unreasonable, but I'm going to excuse it based on these circumstances. Let me emphasize that as strongly as possible. That's not what he said. He said the notice was not reasonable, but I'm going to excuse it. And what was his excuse that he said was reasonable? The reasonable excuse was they tried to give notice.
Yeah.
That's not the standard.
And they tried to give notice because they sent the notice initially, like the day after, to this address that was absolutely worthless.
No. The day after they sent to American Access. Respectfully, that's not what happened. And I want to emphasize the importance of that. The day after the accident, they sent a lien to American Access. They spent 6 months not figuring that out. And then on January 31st of 2018, they had a denial from American Access, although we're not 100% sure why. They took from that date until July of 2019, a year and a half more, to perfect notice on direct auto. So they knew as of January.
So when was the bad notice? The initial notice that went to the wrong address.
That was after January 31st of 2018.
February of 2018 and June. February is when they sent it to the wrong address that you had in the policy, 330 South Wells.
Yes, but that's still 9 months after the accident when he opened the claim, he knew there was UM coverage with direct auto. So I want to emphasize, taking everything from the beginning, the accident was August 19th of 2017. On August 10th of 2017, the day after, he sent notice to American Access, not us.
Right.
He eventually got a notice, or figured out, on January 31st, 2018, almost a year later, that American Access denied liability coverage.
Yeah.
He then sent, in January or February, to the wrong address, got his green card back that wasn't signed, sent 2 faxes to the wrong fax number that bounced, and then, that was in June of 2019. He waited another 6 months to do that. He sent faxes to a fax number, that didn't go through. And he took 6 months to do that.
That's because the insurance company probably changed their fax number when they moved.
Just that was never our fax number. That's not the case. I know you're jocularly saying that, but that was never our fax number. I mean, I don't mean any disrespect to learned counsel, but how many mistakes can be excused? Justice McBride, you asked me a simple question. Let me conclude before I do the rebuttal. This court below decided this notice was ordinarily considered unreasonable as a matter of law at 23 months. But it excused it by explaining that law firm tried to give us notice.
Yeah, they made a reasonable attempt.
They made a reasonable attempt. Well, Judge?
Yeah, because they sent it to an address that you, that was totally wrong. They sent it to an address that the policy said, this is where you send us our notice.
But here's the two problems with that.
So what is unreasonable about sending it there?
Because
the judge said it was reasonable.
Because trying to send notice is not notice when you know you get the green card back unsigned. If I send notice to an address that used to be correct, and the mail comes back bounced, I can't very well say, they got notice. Well, they didn't get notice. They have a bounced letter. Here they had two green cards that weren't signed, and a fax machine that they...
Well, did the judge mean anything when he said they tried when they...
Yes, he did.
And what did he mean by that?
He was excusing Attorney Cheska's malpractice,
okay,
and that's not an excuse.
I don't know that he was excusing malpractice, but do you think there was anything in there about the fact that he tried to send it to the specific address that the insurance company said, this is where you give us our notice?
The problem is...
Was there a kernel of that in the judge's finding?
Yes, and it's wrong. Because trying to send notice is not notice.
Okay.
In other words, trying to send notice means nothing.
Okay.
That would be my argument to you today. Because otherwise, the test is, under Lavorsi and other cases, did we get notice? Not whether he tried to send notice.
Yeah, I don't know how you can ever get notice if you've got the wrong address in the policy.
Well, obviously he did send us notice correctly 2 years later. So he did find our address.
No, I mean, initially, he sent it to an address.
Well, I would give you an answer.
The policy said, this is where you send your notice.
My answer is this. If you send a letter to somebody at the wrong address because they've moved and you get it back bounced, then you do something about it. When you get back a letter that's bounced, you do something.
But an insurance company doesn't have to change any address forms. They don't have to notify their insured that this was the wrong address to begin with.
Under the case law, I don't think that's the standard. The standard is whether he gave notice, not tried to give notice.
The judge found there were some compelling circumstances here, didn't he?
And I would argue that that's an abuse of discretion under Lavorsi because it goes to prejudice. And we're not required to prove prejudice.
Regarding the notice that you said you received from AAA,
yes.
How did you receive that notice?
By email.
By email. And is that email address available on your policies?
No. I don't know. I never looked. I don't think so.
There's no alternative. Send us here at this address or give us notice through our email at such and such.
No, there's a phone number. I don't think there is an email
notice. You can't give notice over the phone.
No, I just... Well, yeah. You could have called us to ask what the new address was.
I know, but you could have sent out to all your insureds what the new address was, too. What's good for the goose is good for the gander.
No.
Okay.
I disagree.
I think in the judge's wisdom and finding, when he said that they tried to give notice, that was part of why he held the way he did. And you're saying he abused his discretion, and I think we understand.
And I would just conclude by saying this. The one thing also I'd emphasize about this whole argument about trying, we're talking about 23 months. We're not talking about...
Yeah, but let me ask you something about the 23 months.
Right.
Would you agree that an insurance policy is a contract?
Yes.
And would you agree that in order to breach a contract, it has to be a material term?
Yes.
So you are claiming that this notice provision is material?
Yes.
Okay. And in determining whether it's material or not, isn't the issue of prejudice involved in that?
It is one of the five elements, but the Supreme Court has repeatedly said it is not a requirement for us to prove. I mean, I don't know how else I can say it.
I don't know how you can say that something is a material breach when it's not important enough. You say, give us notice. You do it in 30 days. You send it to this address. And you're arguing that That can be, how is that material if it's not even a valid address?
Well, Judge.
I mean, really, if it's not even a good address, how is it so important to the insurance company?
But, Judge, they never tried to give us notice within 30 days.
No, not within 30 days.
The first letter was 9 months or a year later. So even the bad letter that they sent that bounced was a year later. I failed to see, let's assume for the moment, you had a circumstance where the accident was August 9th and we didn't get notice for a year later, and that letter went through. You know, the January or whatever it was letter in 2018 went through. That's not reasonable notice either under the case law. I can't find a single published case that says 23 months is reasonable notice under these circumstances. Under any circumstances. I tried to find one in doing my research. I can't find one published case that justifies a 23-month delay.
Were there any cases in your perusal that had the insurance company supplying a bad address in the policy and never making any effort to correct that flawed address?
Not that I saw.
Because you keep talking about under these facts. Well, these facts are rather unusual, aren't they?
No.
I don't. Well, okay. You cite a case to me where the policy had the wrong address.
The facts are not unusual because...
Is there a case you ran across? No.
I can't. Because what I would say is when a letter bounces, you know you've got the wrong address. And these people didn't even send that for a year. For those reasons, Judge...
And during that time frame, we know that the insurance company never notified its insured about the bad address, right?
And we also know that the lawyer who said he knew he had insurance with us never gave us notice, even though he knew he had a UM claim for 23 months. That's his problem and his fault.
Okay.
I would ask, however reluctant I am, for a few moments in rebuttal.
You won't be given those. Ms. Kurtz, the floor is yours.
May it please the court. Again, Angela Kurtz on behalf of the appellee, Takeshi O'Neill.
Can I ask you some questions at the beginning?
Yes.
Were you the lawyer who handled this matter?
Handled it in the Chancery Court or handled it as
from the beginning?
From the beginning, no. Mr. Cheskis handles all of the UM claims, everything pre-suit in our office. I handle the things post-suit.
Does he practice in the field of personal injury?
He does. Almost exclusively. 20, 30 years, much longer than I've been in practice, Your Honor.
Okay.
So, as you just heard, counsel, and I would like to start here, Direct Auto inconsistently has applied its policy and the policy limits throughout the entirety of this case. It applies the policy when it benefits the company, and it disregards it when it doesn't. Counsel said, and Direct Auto has implicitly, at least from the inception of this declaratory judgment action, thrown out the 30-day notice requirement. They know that that is violative of Illinois policy, and this court would not uphold a 30-day notice policy because counsel was actually the attorney on this case. Smith versus American Heartland Insurance Company, which was a First District case in 2017, which held that the Illinois public policy in uninsured motorist cases should mostly track the coverage and the protection provided by the third-party insurance statutes and coverage in the state of Illinois.
Well, let's get to the issue of the case. Sure. I don't know what you're talking about, but the issue of the case here is you people did not send notice to the correct address.
Right.
You got back a receipt that showed it wasn't received. Does that mean you just sit on your hands?
Your Honor, I would submit to you that we received back the green card itself, but as Mr. Cheskis testified at trial, it was not attached to the envelope. So although the green card itself was unsigned, both to the P.O. box, which Mr. Cheskis explained that he got from the letterhead from Direct Auto sending out other notices.
Well, that doesn't show it was ever it was ever received.
We received two separate green cards in February of 2018. It was February 2nd, only 6 months after the accident, and 2 days after we received the denial from American Access, at least the first one. We sent out two different letters. Mr. Cheskis did certified mail. As the policy states, we need to send certified notice to the company. And two different green cards came back detached from the envelopes, albeit unsigned. I understand why the P.O. box one would be unsigned. But common sense and experience told Mr. Cheskis that it was delivered. He testified at trial that he believed that these letters were delivered.
Well, so you're saying the letter did not come back, but a green card did. And normally the letter would be attached, the green card would be attached to the letter.
Right. And if this was a bad address, if the 330 South Wells address was actually a bad address, we would expect to say return to sender, especially if it was true.
What did the green card say, though?
One of them was blank, and it just came back where the signature section would be on the top right corner.
I'm not talking about the
PO
blank.
Box. Sure, and then the other one, I forget which one is which. One of them was stamped just by the United States Postal Service, USPS, with the date, and one was blank.
And what
signature.
Did they say?
That it was addressed, if the green card gets attached to the letter, so is it with the...
Yeah, so you got both back, and neither one of them had the letter attached.
Neither one of them, right. They were detached from the letter, so how the... I mean,
did the letters come back?
The letters did not come back.
Okay.
And nothing was returned to sender, nothing was marked as a bad address, nothing was... There was nothing to inform us from the face of the green cards that Direct Auto no longer was at the Wells Street address or no longer used that PO box. So
let me ask you about American Access. So you said you got notice from them saying that your claim was being denied.
Sure.
All right. Now, was there any information in there indicating that they communicated with Direct Auto?
No, there was not.
Mr.
Cheskas received the denial, and again, he testified at trial. He received the denial, and he didn't recall exactly when, but he must have picked up the phone because by the time, the subsequent communications happened, American Access had the reason. There were actually two denials, one January 31st of 2018, and then one we received in June of 2019.
And you received them, sorry to interrupt, but
sure.
Did you receive them in mail? You know, did you receive a letter, or how did you get your notice from them?
I know that there is a letter, but I cannot tell you right now whether it was mailed or emailed. I don't know. Generally speaking, the practice at American Access is to mail physical hard copy letters, but sometimes they do email us, so that much I do not know, Your Honor.
So in the letter that you received from American Access, did they have any information indicating that they communicated with Direct Auto?
No.
So they didn't even know Direct Auto existed?
I mean, or at least existed
in
the context of this case.
Yes.
I don't think so. Usually, I mean, we're not running away from the fact that the onus is on us to notify Direct Auto in principle.
Okay.
Now, the question is, was notice in this case reasonable? And the facts of the case are very clear. As soon as we got notice from American Access the first time, January 31st, 2018, 2 days later, Mr. Cheskas attempts to notify Direct Auto via the policy, certified letter to the address. He also tries to cover his bases by sending a certified letter to the P.O. box that he has on letterhead from other cases.
So when he communicated with, I'm sorry to interrupt, but so when he communicated with American Access, he did not at the same time tell them, you know, we're also possibly covered under Direct Auto.
I don't think there's any evidence to suggest that he told American Access that.
Okay.
He did because the first notice is very bare bones, just stating Mr. Jimenez is not covered. I know that he picked up the phone and called American Access and asked why, and that Mr. Jimenez was an excluded driver under the policy, but I don't think he went so far as to tell American Access that Direct Auto was the UM carrier.
Okay.
I will front the fact that four months between the time that the letters came back, green cards came back, and that June 2019, beginning of communications in this case again, and the receipt of the second denial from American Access, it is a long time. I'm not here to tell you that it's not. However,
what case says that it could be reasonable?
I'm sorry?
What case says that the 23 months, almost 2 years, could be reasonable?
As counsel said, there's not a case on point. There's a case that says that 120-day notice provision is unreasonable. I think the notice in that case was maybe 130 or 140 days, and that's the farthest out that I had seen. But in this case, the trial judge specifically found that in the totality of the circumstances, given Mr. Cheskas' efforts, given the address in the policy, given the communication, given the fact that Direct Auto, not only, it was not just a letter with the one line, we represent Takeshi O'Neill in July of 2019. They had the police reports. They had the medical records. They had Mr. Cheskas' phone number. We're communicating with him via phone number or phone and email address. They had substantially everything that they needed to investigate this claim as early as July 9th, 2019, a full month before the statute.
How did they obtain this information?
Mr. Cheskas sent it to him. And Mr. Torello testified on the stand. I'll get the exact...
they get all this information and there's 30 days before the statute of limitations.
Yes.
So, I mean, what is your explanation for that? How is that reasonable to them?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I don't understand.
You're saying they had everything, but they had everything almost 2 years after the fact.
It was reasonable given Mr. Cheskas' efforts in this case and that there was still enough time to either investigate the third-party denial, which Mr. Girard...
And file a suit.
Or Direct Auto could have instructed us to file a suit. Forget whether they needed to forward us costs under a separate section of the statute. Forget that for a moment. They never once, in all of these emails, in all of the phone calls, never once said, hey, Mr. Cheskas, we as the UM carrier wish you to file a lawsuit, a third-party lawsuit against Mr. Jimenez. And I know that the policy says we shall, quote-unquote, do nothing to protect the subrogation rights, but that's passive language. Mr. Torello admitted on the policy as Vice President of Claims that there is nothing in the policy that requires us to file a lawsuit against the third party before UM coverage can apply. The onus is on them, as the uninsured motorist carrier, to question the denial, to investigate the denial.
When did these emails start? You referred to some emails.
Sure.
When did the communication via email start with Direct Auto?
I believe the first one was with Martha Diaz on July 3rd, 2019, if I'm not mistaken, through about July 9th, 2013, when it was decided, you know, they told us they were going to file a deck action and communication broke down. So the July 3rd, and I know there's not a big window of time, but there was a lot of communication back and forth, and not once did Direct Auto say, file the third-party statute, file the third-party claim before the statute, protect our interests in that regard, and then we can talk about investigating the uninsured motorist claim thereafter. You know, we filed the AAA action and gave them notice and gave them police report with the medical records all well before what would be the third-party statute a month before that. Any investigation they wanted to do on the accident could have come after that two-year mark, could have come thereafter, as the trial judge found, correctly so, that the case was in the same way as it was maybe a day after the accident. No medical records had been destroyed.
Had a finding of prejudice, and counsel is suggesting that under Lavorsi, they don't have to show any prejudice. If they show that notice was unreasonable as a matter of law, they don't have to in any way suggest that they were prejudiced.
I strongly disagree. I think
prejudice is very... What does Lavorsi say? What is your interpretation? That prejudice is one of the elements? And that they weren't prejudiced at all here?
It goes to the totality of the circumstances as to reasonableness. Prejudice goes to, as Your Honor suggested during counsel's argument, the materiality of the breach. It goes to whether or not anything can be remedied now, even if there is some sort of a breach of contract. And there is nothing that has prejudiced Direct Auto here, apart from they got the notice at 23 months. They didn't direct us to do anything. They didn't do anything themselves. Mr. Torello...
Yeah, well, let me ask you this. What proof do you have that the other driver was uninsured?
So the police report is listed as American Access Insurance, and the proof is the denial letters. We have two of the denial letters.
You have a denial from the insurance company?
From American Access, yes. There's two
of
them.
And do you have a responsibility from the Secretary of State showing no insurance?
We do not have the Illinois Department of Transportation letter, Your Honor,
that the only thing that proves that a person's uninsured?
No, and I questioned Mr. Torello on cross-examination at trial and said, you know, is the IDOT letter the only piece of evidence Direct Auto would accept, and where in the policy is it required that we tender specifically an Illinois Department of Transportation letter to you? He said, that's not only the only thing we'll accept, we will accept denial from the third-party carrier as long as there are reasons stated. And that second letter does state reasons. He was an excluded driver under the policy, and it had the language in there explaining why.
Well, what if that denial is incorrect? Don't you need a responsibility affidavit from the Secretary of State to prove uninsured motors?
Well, if that third-party denial...
I mean, it's either yes or no. Or you don't know.
I don't think so, Your Honor, no.
Well, okay, but you do need that to prove it in a courtroom or before an arbitrator. That's the only thing that will prove it will be that responsibility affidavit, not the insurance company denied coverage. Maybe that coverage was denied improperly.
Well, Your Honor, I think we're talking about what Direct Auto needed at the time notice was given.
Okay.
So at the time notice was given, there was a third-party denial. We could have, you know, we can get the Illinois Department of Transportation letter by the time arbitration comes around at AAA, but if Direct Auto is not seriously contesting whether they're uninsured, it becomes kind of a moot point. And like I said, I questioned Mr. Torello on the stand whether we needed the IDOT letter. He as Vice President of Claims, if he wanted the IDOT letter to prove the uninsured motorist, or the third-party motorist is uninsured, and he said no, not necessarily. He would accept the third-party denial. There's a case on point, Zurich versus Country Mutual, that says that once we receive the denial and the third-party insurer says, disclaims coverage for whatever reason, the burden is not on the uninsured policyholder, for which they've paid policy premiums and have contracted with another insurance company, to then question that denial and go to great lengths, that the onus is on, in this case, Direct Auto, to question that denial. So if they wanted to do anything, they had 30 days to even pick up the phone and call American Access, or to tell us to do something differently, or to send an email out, or to do any number of things. Pick up the phone and call Mr. Jimenez. The only communication they attempted to do with him was send an automatically generated letter, as Mr. Torello said in his testimony, that, you know, it was just automatically generated. They just didn't seriously do anything to question that denial in the 30 days before the third-party statute ran, and then they want to say that, well, we've prejudiced them, and they didn't direct us to file a suit against Mr. Jimenez. So it all circles back to whether 23 months is a reasonable notice, and whether, again, Direct Auto was prejudiced is a factor to consider as to whether everything is reasonable here.
Anything further?
I think the only thing I would like to conclude is just to tie up a quick point that's in the briefs, and that counsel stated just a moment ago again that this is a hit-and-run automobile case. I don't know where the confusion has been, but there's never been a hit-and-run. Direct Auto has been in possession of the police report since July 9, 2019, with a named driver, a named owner, driver's license number, everything. He didn't run. We have his name and address. So this is not a hit-and-run automobile accident. So the briefs on that point, I'd ask the court to disregard any contact or any requirement on that front.
I have one question. So counsel has, more than one occasion during the argument, gave us his interpretation with the trial judge, Matt, when he said the unique circumstances of this case with a credible explanation, implying that counsel who was handling this at the time committed malpractice. What's your interpretation of trial judges?
Are you asking whether I believe Mr. Cheskas committed malpractice?
I'm not asking what you believe. I'm just asking what's your interpretation.
My interpretation is the paragraph before that in the, I don't know what this is, the 1, 2, 3, 4, 5th paragraph of the order, the trial judge's order, shows that we substantially comply with the notice provisions in the policy, and that, yes, this case is extraordinary. I can't think of any other case that I've handled where two different green cards came back unsigned without the letters. That's extraordinary. We send a fax number, fax out. It said delivered. That's extraordinary. Here, you know, we filed for AAA and had a communication. It is an unusual circumstance, but the trial judge says under any circumstance of the case, with credible explanation for the delay, coupled with the absence of demonstrable prejudice to the plaintiff, I think that was a credibility finding on the trial judge's part and a factual finding that this court should not overturn or disturb. He heard the evidence, he evaluated all of the testimony, and he found that we substantially complied with the policy in February of 2018 and continued to try to do so through the 23-month mark.
All right.
Thank you.
Dallas, you may have a brief.
I'll try to be brief to point out the pages that you asked about. Page 299 are the exchange of emails that Justice Reyes asked about when Cheskas sent an email to Direct Auto, and Direct Auto responded and said, we don't have a claim number, we don't know what you're talking about. But that was in July of 2019. Page 292 and 291 are the green cards that are attached. They're blank because nobody signed them. Page 281 was the notice in August 10th of 2017 by Cheskis to American Access. He received a response from American Access back on January 31st of 2018 denying the claim, although not giving a reason. That's page 285. I emphasize, by the way, following Justice Gordon's question, we are not required to accept this blank piece of paper saying we deny the claim to be proof of uninsured motorist status. We only have 30 days to challenge and file a suit. And here's what I emphasize in response to Justice Reyes' question. If the 30-day clause we can't enforce because it's too short a notice, how is it fair to ensure to say to us we only have 30 days to see that a suit is filed, find who the other driver is, and challenge the uninsured status? We only have 30 days to do that. The purpose of reasonable notice is to prevent just that. And if you look at the emails, that's the first time we got a statement or bills or anything. Again, 23 months after the accident. So I would emphasize in response to those questions. Finally, I think I've gone through the page numbers. Even looking from January 31st, 2018, when Cheskis learned that there was uninsured motorist because there was a denial, he still took a year and a half to give us notice. He had our email, obviously, because he sent the AAA and communicated with us. He still took a year and a half. I fail to see how that can be excused under these circumstances. And I don't mean any, as I said in the beginning, I don't mean any disrespect to counsel's boss. I respect her and I respect everybody as part of the process. But it is my job to say he had a job to do. And that's not our fault that he didn't do it. And again, listening to the prior argument by Your Honor, listening to the argument.
I'm not sure, I mean.
No, listening to the principle of what you've said to me now several times. Is the Supreme Court ruling should be enforced as written. Lavorsi says what it says. I hate to be that blunt. It says if there's unreasonable notice, you don't get out of this by a lack of prejudice.
Right, but the judge here said it wasn't unreasonable. That was actually his ultimate finding.
He said it wasn't unreasonable if you take into account their attempt.
Okay, so he made a finding that it wasn't unreasonable. Lavorsi gives factors to consider in whether something is unreasonable, right?
And none of those factors were used by the judge.
Right. Well, I'm just saying that the judge in this case actually made a factual finding after a bench trial that the notice wasn't unreasonable, and he gave his reasons why. You're saying we understand your argument.
He said the notice was ordinarily unreasonable, but I'm going to excuse it for these reasons to find it reasonable. That's what he really said if you read through all the sentences.
So, that's not him concluding it was not unreasonable.
There's a subtle difference. He's excusing the unreasonableness
and
based
finding
on
it reasonable. He's finding that it was not unreasonable.
And I would respond by saying it is an abuse of discretion that trying to give notice is the same as notice.
Yeah.
Thank you very much for this.
Right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you both for your arguments today. The case was well argued and well briefed. It will be taken under advisement, and this court is now...